Put that down right now.
You've got so much potential. You're just not living up to it.
Don't touch that.
You are going to eat that for breakfast if you don't finish it right now.
You ask too many questions.
You're all being a bunch of vultures. Look at you.
Shut up.
You know, it's your choice, but we are going to be so disappointed if you decide to fill in the blank.
You're not hungry. You don't even know what hungry is.
Okay, this is adult time only, so go play somewhere else. Kids, out of here.
Do you want a spanking?
No. She sounded serious. I wasn't nervous until now. And I'm out of them.
You're out.
Do you want to do the rest of yours?
If you don't stop crying, I'm going to give you something to cry about.
Oh, I did get
that
one, too.
Shut up, you little brat. I got that one a lot. You're book smart, but you got no common sense. You have never been hungry a day in your life. I had more than Ren did. I win, no, I lose. The reason we did this is to possibly stir up your own memories. It's easy to come to something like this and sit and just very gently, at a surface level, consider whether what the people are saying has anything to do with you. We wanted to maybe remind you, if anybody ever said anything harsh and quick and mean to you, that it kind of lives in there. It'll stir you back up. And I was afraid I was going to cry if we started doing these, because sometimes when somebody says it right to your face and they're not smiling and they're not saying, psych, just joking, I'm playing, it still stirs that little kid back up to be afraid. And so that's the purpose of our little demonstration.
And that's why we yelled the insults that we received as children, not at each other. We traded. So I wasn't yelling the insults at Sandra that her mother actually yelled at her. That way we didn't get too emotional, hopefully. But to introduce ourselves, Sandra is a mother of three. Many of you know her from the unschooling list for many, many years. She's been a clear and pressing voice. Many here today can understand me when I say that she's been a mentor and a sage and sometimes a kick in the behind, which is what I needed. Because of her she's to the depth convicted of unschooling and gentle parenting, she's able to help so many others find the path to joyful unschooling and to change how they do things. And just in case you don't know, her book called Moving a Puddle is now available. I'm Ren, also at the list since 2000, mother of four, and I try to be a voice of encouragement by sharing my stories. And helping people discover their creative genius is what I do outside of the whole unschooling thing, and I found that they're really lovely partners.
I realized when Kirby was still a baby, too young to discuss it with me, I realized that if I had just done what my mother had done without any more thought, which is what I think a lot of mothers knew, new mothers, I would have been much more controlling. I would have yelled at my kids a lot more. I'm not saying I never did, okay, but I'm saying that I realized when I did it, it's like, wait, why am I doing this? I'm just doing this because it was done to me. When I'm tired, when I'm hungry, when I can't think of what to do, I become my mom. And when I was little, I was told what to do and how to do it. Not just what to do, but do it this way. Hold it like that. I was told when and where and what to eat and how much of it to eat and when to stop eating. I was told how to hold a fork, how to hold a spoon, how to sit. And I'm not saying it doesn't matter. I'm just saying sometimes the food might be more important than your posture. I've been sent away from the table because I wasn't sitting right. And so the priorities, if people are not really considering what their priorities are and mindfully thinking about why they're doing what they're doing, it's very easy to be your mom, turn off thought, and just do what was done to you. I had to ask to do anything when I was little, and the answer was usually no. I have a quote on my website from a really good writer named Rin Allen, and she said, "As a child, I was taught that fashion and all it entails was worldly, and that Barbie stuff promoted low self-esteem. Baloney. What promoted low self-esteem was being told my interests weren't worthy." And I'll let you tell Rin more about that.
What I was saying is that all of their shunning and shaming of all of my fashion interests didn't stop me from pursuing my love of fashion. It just slowed me down. So it didn't work out so well on my parents' end. Some of the things that I got, my mom got in over her head, I think. She had three biological children and then adopted three high-needs children. And what went with that is a lot of yelling and nagging. And so what happened in my house, there was a lot of love, too, but I learned that when you want something done, get really loud. And I'm still having to relearn that. When you want something done, you harp on somebody or you start crying and guilting them into doing it. And that's what I started out doing with my child.
I haven't pulled up. You're tall. You're too tall for that.
I'm too tall for this mic, I guess. So loads of nagging and yelling about just about everything, from towels on the floor to finishing food, that we're not helping enough, that we're ungrateful, all these kind of things. As far as school went, I got a lot of, from my parents, you need to quit daydreaming so much. Start focusing. Pay attention. You're not living up to your potential. Daydreaming was a bad thing, apparently. My sister, who's right here in the front, got a lot of, quit being such a social butterfly. Quit talking so much. So apparently all the socialization they wanted us to learn in school wasn't a good thing either. So I was trained to yell. I was trained to view chores and learning as something that you avoid. I saw my parents as adversaries. Adults were the enemy. And I began to instill that in my own children early on. I thought I was a rebellious person. I was thick-headed. All of these things that they were trying to teach me, I internalized them, and it went into a negative self-image. It didn't teach me the things they wanted me to learn. I did learn I am rebellious, and that ended up being a good thing. It probably saved me from buying into their image of me too much. So that's what I had learned. To this day, though, I can feel this like pit of anger in my belly when things get out of control. I can feel it start to come on. I can feel my mother start to come out in me. But now I am more able to say, uh-oh, wait a minute, there's an old tape playing. I'm not mad at that child. I'm just replaying something that I was taught as a child. And to be able to stand outside of that and to feel that pit of anger and not react on it, that's coming a long ways. That's the whole crux of gentle parenting, I believe. It doesn't mean you aren't going to play old tapes. It doesn't mean you aren't going to react. But to be able to take that moment and change how you finish the situation, that's the key. So when I hear my mother's voice now coming through me, I can pause and I can change that tape. The steps toward change. For me, beautifully, my parents were actually one of the steps in helping me change because they grew and they learned and they got older and more mature and looked back and realized the mistakes they had made. So I was an adult by then, older teen, young adult, but they began to talk to me about the wounds they had given me in childhood. And that was tough for me. It was tough for me to examine all of that because I thought they were wonderful. And I had just buried the hurt and internalized it. I was messed up. What they had done wasn't wrong. So when they started talking to me about this, I began to examine things I had never examined. And so they were one of the first steps in helping me to shift, you know, make that shift toward positive parenting. I attended a church. We grew up in it. It was very cult-like. It was very strict. And if you didn't spank your children, at some point you would be encouraged to. And so my parents had been encouraged to spank, and that had really led them into a whole different kind of parenting than they might have done on their own. Well, when they started telling me not to spank and to do things differently and to examine my wounds and try and let go of the anger, I would sit in church and I would hear parents spanking children, and I began to cringe. It began to eat at my soul. And boy, that was tough. That was really hard. And then I realized that I had been perpetuating that same hurt. When I heard other children screaming and crying as their parents hurt them, it did something to me. I couldn't do it anymore. So eventually I did get out of the church and got far away from that kind of parenting, but it took me so long to connect the positive parenting with how I viewed children. So that hung me up for a very long time. My mom actually paid for positive parenting classes. I took these classes, I read the books, and I thought, oh, this is so great. This is such a cool way to raise children. But my views on children hadn't changed yet. I was still seeing them as maybe not flawed, but definitely needing discipline, definitely needing more than guidance. And so because I couldn't connect that, I could not adopt these principles deep down. And so that was a very slow evolution for me. And it wasn't until I started reading about unschooling and how perfect and whole children were from the moment they were born. And when they were acting out, they were still perfect and whole. They just didn't have better tools to use. Once I could see that, suddenly all these positive parenting practices and all these things my parents had told me, I began to be able to use them. So that was the critical moment for me.
I came from the other end of the peaceful parenting. I was doing that first and then came to unschooling. When I was 30-ish, a little older, I was married to Keith. We didn't have any children at all. We hadn't decided whether we wanted to have any children, and I broke my leg. I've broken my leg twice. Once has to do with this conference, and once has to do with the story I'm going to tell you. So I broke my leg, and Keith had a job interview in the other end of the state. He would have to spend the night. He would have to be gone for a day and a half, and I was in a serious cast. I could not get up at all. I couldn't take care of myself. So Keith arranged for another couple of friends of ours to come over and take care of me, and I flipped out. And I said, no, they're not going to take care of me. If somebody else comes to take care of me, I'm just going to lie here in my own poo until you get back, because no one else can help me, because I'll be ashamed, embarrassed. I don't want anyone else to be inconvenienced on my account. I'm just crying and going crazy. And he's going, why are you going crazy? And I said, I don't know. So he got the two friends to come over to discuss the possibility with me of them staying with me, and it turns out, I didn't know, both of them had alcoholic parents. They knew my mom had been an alcoholic. And I didn't know that there's really, that's not something we had discussed a lot. They both came over, they talked to me for a while, and one of them left the house while the other one kept haranguing me. I was crying, and brought back a book called Adult Children of Alcoholics. And they talked to me about this, and they said, you have done us a lot of favors over the years. You've been really nice to us. You've given us birthday presents. You've fed us. You've given us rides. Why won't you let us wipe your butt? And I burst into tears. It's like, because you know. And it turns out what my problem was not, it was not unique to me. It was just very, very typical of people who have grown up with this continuous, sit down, be quiet. Nobody wants to hear what you have to say. Shh, hush. And I had hushed to the point that I couldn't really communicate openly with other people very well. You know, it was unhealthy. So they talked me into going to these meetings. When I could get out and get into a car, one of them started taking me to a weekly meeting of Adult Children of Alcoholics. Without any thought that I was about to get pregnant in 2 months, I started going to these meetings. A lot of the people were in therapy, like group therapy or whatever, recovery for drugs or codependency, but mostly it was problems of a family upbringing. They're from dysfunctional families, and that was a big deal in those days in the 80s. There was a lot of new research going on, but a lot of the people who were going to those meetings had a teddy bear, and that was something their therapist had told them to do. So they take this teddy bear around, and they be really gentle to the teddy bear, and they let the teddy bear sit in a nice place, and they say yes to the teddy bear. You know, so it's like therapeutic. I didn't have a teddy bear, and I thought it was weird, because all I was doing is going to the meetings, and then I got pregnant. And I thought, this is where it's really at. My mom, when I was 19, accidentally got pregnant, like one of those late in life things, and it was a half brother of mine, and I saw the way she treated him, and it was really bad. And I thought, if this is the way she's treated him after years of thought, she must have been really terrible with my sister. I talked to some aunts and uncles, and they confirmed that. So I thought, here's what I can do to heal myself, is not be nice to a teddy bear I don't even really personally biologically know, but maybe from the very beginning when this baby's born, I could be the way that I am learning gradually now people can be. Because that's what they would say. They'd say, consider what would have happened if your parents could have been different. And it was easy to do. It's like, what if when I said, can I run on these parking bumpers, or can I run up this ramp, or can we go down the slide one more time? If the people had said yes instead of no. And so I just tried to do that. If my immediate thought is no, I feel that. I know that feeling to go no. And I would hear that no, and I would think the words, what if you said yes? There are some sayings in 12-step programs. One is, how important is it? And I would, that's a little slogan to think about. How important is it? And sometimes the mean version is, who's going to die? You know, what's it going to kill if you say yes? you know, what part of the world will end if you get there at 4:05 instead of 4 o'clock? Although, as I was on my way here, Ben Lovejoy posed dramatically in the hallway with his finger on his watch. So it seems it was going to kill a great 5 minutes of the conference. But I hurried. I ran. yes. So that was pretty good. And I kept going to those meetings until Marty was walking. And so that was good for them. They don't know it. They didn't know anything, right? They knew, as Kirby said when somebody asked him about school, he said, I have no basis for comparison. Then I went to La Leche League meetings when Kirby was 4 months old. So within just about a year's time, I had two groups to draw on, both of which were saying, you know, it's really not only okay for parents to be really gentle and nice, it's really highly valuable. And so I was surrounded by people who encouraged me to take Kirby out if he was crying, to interrupt a conversation and say, wait, Kirby needs me. I was surrounded by people who said, you know, it's really okay to listen to little kids. And not everyone has that advantage. So that was good. But I wasn't thinking about unschooling. I was also reading books in those days, a couple that were new and really valuable to me, again, because there weren't people like Ren and, you know, Kelly and Pam and people writing all the stuff that we get to read every day, were a book called Whole Child, Whole Parent, and another one called Chop Wood, Carry Water. And at the time I read that book, I really liked it. I read it twice. It's got a broken spine. It's kind of worn out. And I read it when I started looking at it the third time. The very first chapter has references to growing without schooling in John Holt. I had read John Holt's school stuff, but this was his teach-your-own kind of stuff. And I didn't follow those references because I didn't care yet. Then all through that time, I was also in a group called the Society for Creative Anachronism, and I had seen from that, I was like the national president for a while, and we had a lawsuit from some people saying we were supposed to be an educational organization, and we weren't being educational because there were never any opportunities for people to sit down at desks and have paper and pencil and learn. And I made the winning argument in those days that was not the kind of educational organization we were. We had not chartered ourselves as a nonprofit corporation to run classes on the Middle Ages, but to have opportunities for people to have the need to research costumes, armor, food, to learn those things so that they could do what we were doing. So in the course of putting on a feast or a tournament, people needed to know, what furniture do we need? What would they have had to drink? Rin's been in the SCA in more recent years. And so I knew, because of that, that adults, for fun, would do hours, months, years of serious research and actually build things without being paid, without getting points, without, you know, they would do it because of its intrinsic value and the enjoyment they would get. So I knew that. I knew that in a want-a-lawsuit way. Not all my memories are bad either. So it can be valuable to do the anti-mean mom memories thing. But I have really good memories, and that's fine because that goes into the better choices. You know, sometimes my mom did a really cool thing. One good thing she did was when we became teenagers, there were four of us became teenagers about the same time. My parents adopted two cousins of mine. They took them in when they were little, so there were four of us all about the same age. And when we became teenagers, something, I don't know what, caused my mom to say, if I say no, you can ask me why. Because she realized she was saying no, just like automatically, no, no. Do you know why you said no? No. And so she said, okay, if I say no, you can ask me why. And if I have a good reason, that's it. And if I don't have a good reason, you can do the thing. But you could, you know, you got one more rebuttal, that's all. And we use that, because sometimes, sure enough, she had said no. Can I go out for Coke with Michael? No. Okay, why not? Or when is a good time? And she would think, and she'd go, oh, no, I guess you can. So I thought, okay, why wait for 14 years? I'll just do that from the beginning. And then I didn't make them ask. I would ask myself. You know, I would do that whole little dialogue myself. It's like, okay, I feel like saying no. Why? And I would. And from their point of view, it just looks like I pause for a couple of seconds. And is that unhealthy? Maybe not. No, maybe that's okay. And so I always tried to say yes, or to say soon, or we can't do it now, but we can do it later. And that felt so good because it was healing for the memory of me. And some people think that if you do that, you're reviling your parents or you're vilifying your parents. But it wasn't that. It was like, what if my mom had had these kinds of good influences? What if her relatives and her own memories had been such that she could be a little more patient and a little gentler. Wouldn't that have been nice? It would have been nice for her. It would have been nice for us. And so it didn't. As some people are afraid that they would do, if they always go another way than their mom went, that it would be a rejection of their mother. It was kind of a blessing on her, because she, inside her, had this wounded kid who was, she would have assured me at length, hit harder than I'd ever been hit, and hungrier than I'd ever been, and lived in a crummier house than I ever lived in, and never had her own room. You know, she could go on at length about what snow she walked through. And it was West Texas, so I start to doubt it. But if you have that nervous feeling that if you don't do like your mom did, you'll be rejecting your mom, maybe you'll be healing not just yourself and your child, but maybe you're healing the whole system a little bit. That's possible. Go ahead.
Well, Sandra and I might not have had ideal models, but the more I talk to people, the more I realize that most of us don't have ideal models for gentle parenting. Very few people have a very effective model. So where do you start? How do you create something that you've had absolutely no example for? I think this conference and the lists and the amount of information available to us today makes it so much easier for those of us treading where it's uncharted territory for our families. And Sandra talked about pausing, about having that internal dialogue in her head. She talks a lot about deep breathing, taking a breath. Something that hit me between the eyes at one point in my search for being a better parent was Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. It's kind of geared for business people. He's come out with many more since then, geared for teens or families or parents, whatever. But the thing that hit me between the eyes is he said, between an action and a reaction, there is a moment. And in that moment, there is a choice. And so before you react, you have a choice. I never felt like I had a choice before. I was just feeling things and then acting out on them. And when he said I had a choice, well, that sure shifted the responsibility of how I was treating my child at that point. Something happened at the first conference that was a really nice moment for me. Sandra talked about breaking her leg twice in her life, and one of them being related to the conference. Well, the first time I ever met Sandra in my life was when she was high on morphine in a hospital bed. That was the first moment I met her. So I don't know how much she remembers about me, but I remember that visit quite clearly. And I was there to take pictures of her. It was this ha-ha funny thing. We're going to get pictures of Sandra at the first Live and Learn conference. And look at her with her cast and in the hospital bed. Funny, funny. So I'm there with my camera and my little 1.5-year-old Jalen, who has been a very, very busy, energetic soul since he came to this earth. And every time I got in position like this, up to the bed to take a picture, he jumped in front of the camera and stuck his nose right in the lens. And what's that, Mom? And just all curious about it and touching. And about the fourth time he did that, I still hadn't gotten a picture yet, the reaction was starting to come. The old parenting tape of stop that, get away, go sit down. I'm trying to take a picture. I was getting cranky. And I don't know if it was just, you know, I mean, I had been evolving for a long time here, so this moment was really great, but it might have had something to do with the fact that Sandra Dodd was sitting there watching me, too. I don't know for sure. But either way, I thought, you know what? This is what he needs right now. He wants to know about the camera. And if I get a picture of Sandra in the hospital bed or not, is not a big issue. Or if I get it in 5 minutes, because she's not going anywhere. And so I stopped, and I knelt down on his level, and I said, Jalen, look. This is the camera. And we started looking at it and talking about it. And then I just simply said, see Sandra there in the bed? I'm going to take a picture of her now. Can you wait just a minute? And he toddled off to a corner and sat down and waited. So for me, those kind of moments were big breakthroughs. Just coming down to the child's level, seeing the world through their eyes, and not letting that old reaction well up into a reaction.
Can I say something about that day?
Sure.
In my memory later, in my drug-addled vague memory, I thought she had 2 kids with her because he moved so fast.
That could have been easy to do even when you weren't on morphine. He's very fast. I don't remember much about that conference as far as speakers, because I saw the Jalen behind in the diaper, and that's what I chased the whole conference. So it was still worth every moment. So those kind of moments are very reaffirming when you start to have those and you realize that the way you were parenting is no longer controlling you. Autopilot parenting, the knee-jerk reaction parenting, the old tapes coming on, you're not using that moment. It's just not taking that moment of choice between action and reaction. And, you know, one of the tools of deep breathing, I don't think you can stress the importance of that enough, because it gives you a pause, it gives you a stop. And I have a couple little things I want to read about stopping and breathing. The first one is by Thich Nhat Hanh. Some of you may have read his work. This is from Touching Peace, Practicing the Art of Mindful Living. He said, stopping is the basic practice of meditation. To keep our flowerness fresh, we have to learn how to stop our worries, anxieties, agitation, and sadness so that we can find peace and happiness and smile again. When things are not going well, it is good to stop in order to prevent the unpleasant destructive energies from continuing. Stopping does not mean repressing. It means, first of all, calming. If we want the ocean to be calm, we don't throw away its water. Without the water, nothing is left. When we notice the presence of anger, fear, and agitation in us, we don't need to throw them away. We only have to breathe in and out consciously, and that alone is enough to calm the storm. We do not need to wait for a storm to begin practice. When we are not suffering, conscious breathing will make us feel wonderful, and it is the best way to prepare ourselves to deal with troubles when they come. And that leads right into kind of filling up your bucket, filling up your toolbox before you're faced with a difficult situation in your family. Peaceful parenting does not mean the absence of conflict. We're human beings. We're living with sometimes many different personalities in one house. There are going to be conflicts. There is going to be some big waves. The key is that you need to learn how to surf. And one other little thing that I wanted to read is about breathing. I thought it was really beautiful. This was written by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who writes incredible books about parenting and spirituality. But he says, all of Walden Pond is within your breath. The miracle of the changing seasons is within the breath. Your parents and your children are within the breath. Your body and your mind are within the breath. The breath is the current connecting body and mind, connecting us with our parents and our children, connecting our body with the outer world's body. It is the current of life. There are nothing but golden fish in this stream. All we need to see them clearly is the lens of awareness.
When I try to slow myself down, the breathing is good. Ideas help me. Some people are very visual, and some people have to picture something peaceful. Some people are very physical, and maybe they need to run around the house. But I'm very verbal, and I think in words almost always. And so I need to remember my priorities or my plan, and that helps. For the longest time, I'm old. I'm 52. When I was younger and I first ever knew much about therapy at the time, it was, you know, a lot of Freudian and Jungian stuff where they talk to you for years before they ask you, now, how were you feeling the day you came in here? And now they're doing cognitive therapy pretty consistently, short-term therapy, where you say, I have this problem. I have a big problem. Something's happening next week, and I'm afraid of it. And they go, okay. What they do about that is they say, how is it you're afraid? Where are you afraid? What tricks can we give you today that can get you through the week? And then if you want to come back next week, fine. But, I mean, really, a lot of psychology now is focused toward helping people change what they're thinking and feeling so that they can get through this next week, month, year. And it's a very different approach. And I think that helps a lot with kids, because if you know that you want to be a more gentle parent, just having that vague idea is not going to do it for you. You need to say, okay, now, how would a gentle parent act? Why am I afraid of being gentle? Whose voice is saying, you better get on that kid or he's going to be ruined? He'll steal cars and go to prison if you don't make him go to sleep at 10 now today. So you need to talk back to those voices a little bit. You need to think of what your priorities are. Think of how you want to be. And that has helped me a lot to just reflect on why I started to say what I did and what's the worst thing will happen if I say something different. And it's not a long conversation. It's not like you have to sit and think for half an hour. There's a tape for sale in the other room, a talk that I did with Richard Prostowski a few years ago, and my main part of that talk, the best part, was to say, if you don't give yourself a choice, you haven't really made a choice. If you just do the first thing you think of, even if it's a really pretty cool thing, you didn't make a choice, you just reacted. So always give yourself two choices. If you're really, really angry with a kid and you're really new to this and you think, I would like to backhand him so hard, or I will just say, please sit in that chair till I'm not so mad anymore. Go with the chair. The next time you might think, well, I could make him sit in that chair, or I could just ask him why he's so mad at me. And go, okay, well, you know, that doesn't get your adrenaline up so much. And so pretty soon your decisions, the two choices you're making will be incrementally more peaceful, more sensible, calmer. And so at your own pace, at your own level, you gradually come to better choices, but always make a choice. Because unless you think I could do this or that, what choice did you make? And it's a cheap trick, but effective. My mom was jealous of me because my life was cushier than hers. My dad liked me better than her dad liked hers. And she was, you know, it would be really easy to say my mother was immature. And I think a lot of objective witnesses might have looked at her and went, wow, she's kind of immature. But I think she was wounded. I think she had never really grown up to the point that she could think of things in a calm, adult, nurturing way sometimes. It was easier for her to just react out of jealousy. And she was just a confused person who had been wounded herself and didn't have any help or tricks to get out of that. I could be jealous of my kids, and occasionally a little bit I am. You know, I just have that sort of hot feeling of, that's not fair. That's not fair. I didn't get to do that. But I choose to be their partner. Because that's a trick I learned in La Leche League, to think of them as adversaries, not as adversaries, but as partners. You know, I was Kirby's buddy to help him figure out how to do those things. It wasn't either I lose or Kirby loses. We could both win. And that, even as their teens, has helped me a lot. If Kirby's having a really good time with his friends, that makes me the mom of a kid who's really having a good time with his friends. And that's not that far to go, but it really feels good. And sometimes Keith and I will just have a moment when all the kids are out, scattered out, gone, doing something cool. You know, we'll review. Like sometimes Marty will tell Keith where he's going, and I'll know where Kirby went, and we'll get together and go, well, okay, Marty's here, and then they're going to go out to the Frontier restaurant, and Kirby went to watch wrestling, and then they're going to so-and-so's house. And then we just like kind of smiles, like that is so cool that they're out doing really neat things that we didn't have to orchestrate, we didn't have to pay for, you know, we didn't have to do, we didn't have to arrange these things. And we could resent it, but that doesn't make anyone's life better. So we revel in that their lives are more fun than ours were. That's neat. And that was a conscious decision we made, because our partners, somebody on our team is doing well, the whole team's doing better. It also helps to find supportive people. Some people have them in person, some people have them in books or online, or sometimes there's just a movie that if you watch that movie a lot, that's comforting and it reminds you. But whatever trigger and comfort and help you have, go there. When you feel embarrassed that all your decisions are too wimpy and mushy and you're being too nice and these kids don't appreciate anything, that's another trick, is come back where somebody will go, no, let me remind you why this is a really good thing.
I already did that part, I'm going to go ahead
and read the letter from
you. Yeah, well, I think I skipped ahead a little. Not that it matters,
okay.
But what I was going to share that I miss sharing is really cool. My dad and even my grandparents have become huge advocates for gentle parenting. My dad's going to be here this weekend, actually, and I'm hoping that... I'm almost hoping he doesn't buy the tape, because it's really hard to hear your kids stand in front of lots of people and tell them all the things they did wrong. But he's really cool because he is the one that very loudly advocated for us to be gentle, for us to be kind. And my grandfather began to. And my dad wrote this beautiful letter to me when Trevor was very, very tiny, old enough to be into things and being a toddler, still very little. But he wrote a letter after he'd visited us in Portland one time, and he wrote, "It was really great seeing you two again and Trevor for the first time. What a precious little life. And the greatest thing you can do for Trevor is just love one another and cherish one another. You know, Ren, I really was serious when I told you to just pick Trevor up and love him when you want to spank him. I don't give this advice because I was so expert at it, rather because I can now look back and evaluate my own mistakes. Just keep loving that little guy like his life depends on it. It does. This is kind of a short letter, but nothing better than nothing, isn't it? Believe me, I think about you guys every day. Keep in touch with your sisters and brothers, Ran. It means more than you can imagine. I love you all dearly, Dad. Trying to hold it together here. My sister's sitting in the front crying, so if I break down, that's why. I read that and I cried when he sent it. And I also thought he was nuts. I thought, okay, when my son is being horrible and he's being bratty and ugly and I hug him, I'm just going to teach him to act that way. But I was dead wrong. And Trevor didn't get the benefit of that knowledge early on. He did later. But fast forward a few years to a scene with my sister-in-law. She was visiting for the first time in years in Pensacola, and we went to Walmart. Sierra was tiny at the time, toddlerish, 2 or 3 maybe. And I got the chance to demonstrate hugging someone who was having a meltdown. And we were out in the parking lot. It was a meltdown in the store, drug out through the parking lot. We had to leave the store. She was tired and exhausted, so we left. And my sister-in-law was embarrassed the entire way out to the car and wouldn't walk with us. It was a very loud tantrum. But she needed me, and we got to the car, and I knew if I put that child in the car and drove away, she was going to scream the whole way home, and she was going to feel unloved and ignored, and nothing was going to be good or right. So I just knelt down outside the car and hugged her. And what happened at that moment is my sister-in-law started yelling at me that I was ruining my child, that she was going to learn to be awful, that I was encouraging her to act like a brat. And I just sat there and kept hugging her and told my sister-in-law to get away. And it was really wonderful because she calmed right down. We got in the car and we drove home. And I had to listen to my sister-in-law the whole way home. And I ended up making her leave my home that night. And that kind of leads us into the next little segment, which is about problems you can encounter with the gentle parenting.
And one of them is the interface with relatives and friends. We've had some childless friends who were sure we didn't know what we were doing. We've had some friends with children who just flat told us. There's one family, just she told me one time, if you don't hit Kirby, he's going to grow up and hit you. And she, you could guess. You could guess what happened. She hit her kids, and I heard a few years ago that her son, who's between Kirby's and Marty's ages, hit her when he was a big teenage boy. He smacked her a good one. I haven't gone to say, so, hey, I heard, Jeff, did you? But, I don't want to go, to her. But the fact is that Kirby and Marty are very, very gentle guys. And I did try to hit Kirby. I'm kind of changing the subject now, but when Kirby was 11 or so, I got really mad at him for being mean to Holly. He was hateful to Holly, and I wanted him to take it back and apologize, and he just told me Holly was stupid, not stupid, whatever, one of those things that 12 or 13-year-old boys say. And so the mother that's still within me tried to hit him in the face, and he blocked it with a karate block, just very smoothly, no expression on his face, and I thought, wow, those karate lessons are worth the money. Because he just kept me from hitting him, because otherwise I would have had to say, oh yeah, I hit Kirby just a few years ago, but now I can say I haven't hit Kirby for years. And I'm glad. I'm glad. And I was glad to see that he didn't do the grab me and throw me down either. He was fine with the, no, don't hit me. It's easy to do what other people expect you and want you to do and tell you to do and threaten that if you don't do, it'll be terrible. And it's hard to be strong enough and brave enough to just not do it, to just say, I hear you, I know why you think that, now go home tonight. You need to not be here right now. It is not easy at all. Grandparents' feelings might be hurt if the grandkids are not being treated as you were, but there are a lot of grandparents that have done the same thing Ren's dad did, who, when they see their grandchildren, get all soft and sweet and effusive and generous and downright fun. And so that can be healing, too, in that sort of healing inner child way. If you can see your parents be really sweet and gentle to your kids, then that's helpful. My mom isn't alive now, but she wasn't critical of the way I was with my kids. She said I was a good mom. She would say, you're really good with your kids. And I knew, she wasn't being flattering. She was just stating the facts. You know, I mean, because I was paying a lot of attention to them, I was trying to be good with them. And so I would say, well, thanks. She was a crummy babysitter, and she tried a few times. It was terrible. She was very nervous and couldn't think of anything fun to do. So you just have to deal with each of your relatives or friends as they come along. But we know, we've both had problems with people in our lives saying that it's just not going to work. You don't know what you're doing. But as the kids get older, I mean, there are a lot of teens here this weekend. You can talk to some of them and see what you think, see if they're ruined. I'm pretty confident about mine. The theme of this whole conference is ages and stages. And I thought at first they're talking about ages of childhood. You know, they're toddlers, they're older, they're teens. But I think parents go through stages too. Part of why I'm more patient and gentle now is probably just because I'm older. I didn't really realize when Kirby was little that when he was grown I would be 20 years older. I'm a little disappointed to discover that. But it's easier to be patient when you have years of experience of what patience will do for you. And so parents go through stages too. And if we are working to accept that learning is natural, we should seek and welcome that learning in ourselves.
And depending on the relationship you have with your family, you may need to put some space between you and those negative people. I was lucky to have the shift in my family and have the support. But Heidi and I were talking last night, and she said, you know, I was the people pleaser. I was the one that wanted to keep everyone happy, and I needed that support from my mother. So at that time in her life, she wasn't able to really tell mom to back off or this is my turn now. It's hard. And you might have to examine those relationships really closely and decide if they're helping you be a gentle parent or if they're hurting you and bringing you down. And it's really, I think it's necessary with unschooling and with gentle parenting. If you don't have one now, you're going to need to develop one, and that's a thick skin. You're going to have to learn that when people say negative things or they put down your lifestyle, that it's going to bounce right off. They're not judging you. It's not about you. It's not about your family. They are just filtering their own life experiences. It's about them. And I think we have to create a haven for gentle and respectful parenting to flourish. And, you know, that takes a lot of examination, not only of self-examination, but maybe your surroundings. Do you have friends that encourage you? Do you have family? Can you create a community of support? Even if it's just a little bit, you know, it doesn't take much. One other person can really help. So, you know, if you've got that negativity, put some space between you and them. Detach a little bit emotionally from it, and make a haven in your home for these kind of philosophies to take place.
Learning to be a better parent than we would have been otherwise is a really big deal. You don't have to move to another country. It's not like moving to the moon. You don't have to, you know, have surgery. You don't have to invest a lot of money. It's a little thing, but it's a huge thing. You know, what on earth could be more important than making yourself the good kind of person you want to be for the benefit of other people? People will say, well, you didn't study very much to do this. This is just something you're doing. You know, you're just an amateur. You're just a mom. You're just a housewife. But what PhD dissertation in the world could be better than one that makes people's lives better? So don't belittle what you're doing when you're working to be the best person you can be. We don't need committee approval. We don't need a college degree to do what we're doing. You only need the desire and the willingness and the practice to do that. This Monday night, I had an incident. I was insulted on a list that I'm not on, and someone, we were finishing up our packing. It's like dark the night that we're trying to leave town, drive for 2 days. Holly was in my office, and I was trying to help her go through her list. You know, did you remember this, 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 this? And she's looking over my shoulder, and darn it, she reads really well now. I had an instant message there from Pam Sarushian, and we were talking about what we're going to do about this thing having happened, excuse me. And Holly said, what's going on? What's this? And I didn't want to stop packing and doing that and tell Holly my problems. And so I just very briefly said, somebody had lied about Kirby and his college classes, and she just said some things about me, and we're just, you know, I want to make some answer to it before we leave town. And Holly said, like what? And I said, well... She said I was just being reactionary to my mom having been an abusive alcoholic. And Holly did this. Holly has a little posture you may see this weekend. She kind of reared her head back and went, what's wrong with that? And there it was. Because I think if someone has experienced something and they know that they can do different or better, why wouldn't they react to that? You know, what's wrong with that? They should. People should react to abuse and neglect. People should move toward a better way of being. And even if you start in a really good place, if you can do a little better, why not? You know, what's wrong with that? I can't begin to be ashamed of having reacted to my mother's bad behavior, you know, and for copying some of her good days, and for vowing not to copy her bad days. My children know a way of life that most adults can't even imagine. And they live in a way that most people don't even believe could exist. And they live that way directly because I chose to react to my mother's bad example.
In closing, I just want to kind of add to what Sandra just said. I guess sitting in church and hearing parents spank was my way of reacting, but now I think I would have walked back there and taken the child and offered to walk the child around. So I think reacting to abuse in public, reacting to it in your family in a gentle way, in some way to let people know it's not acceptable, that can change the world. And just by parenting our own children in a method that they don't grow up with this baggage and they don't go into parenting with those same tapes, that's changing the world in a huge way. You're making yourself immortal, really. Sharing joy, sharing these things, they travel through the next generation, and that can leave a legacy that you don't know how it will touch people hundreds of years from now. Something that has really helped me also, lots of times we see the, you know, cleaning the house, the children fighting, the messes, the runny noses, the nights cleaning up puke, or whatever happens in families. This is the stuff we have to get done so we can get to the really cool stuff. All the fun unschooling things we're going to do, all the adventures we're going to have. We got to get all this stuff done to get to the important stuff. But you know what? The runny noses and the fighting and all that stuff, it is the important stuff. And how we handle that, that is the most important thing you will do. And that's really helped me respond to these moments more appropriately, is just seeing every bit of the grungy details of family life as my practice. Every moment, every day, that's my practice. And how well I do it. Really, if you think about it, once you've made a decision to do something, once you've said, okay, the dishes are worth cleaning, the nose is worth wiping, whatever it is you're doing, once you've chosen to do that activity, you have two choices after that, as far as I see it, to do it well or to do it poorly. Gentle parenting is simply about doing it all well.
Thank you all. That's the end of that. I have...